representing the appellant is Carl Lewis. Mr. Lewis, you may present the appellant's opening argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Carl Lewis. I'm an attorney with Idaho Legal Aid, representing the appellant, Christina Cutler. I've prepared an outline for today's oral argument, Your Honors, that pretty closely follows the appellant's brief. But I don't think I've got a lot of new information that's not contained in the briefing, but I wanted to highlight the points that I consider most important. However, at any time that the court wishes to pose questions, I'm certainly happy to address them in whatever order they come. Right. This appeal concerns notice pleading and some of the consequences that follow, that can follow when notice of a cause of action becomes a question. The complaint in this matter consists of four distinct parts. There was one, parties, jurisdiction, and venue; two, some general allegations; three, a single cause of action labeled as count one, account stated; and four, a prayer for relief. Now, I hadn't handled an account stated case before, so I had to crack open the law book and see what it takes to establish an account stated. What I found is it requires three elements, but the one that's relevant to this appeal is, and to this complaint, is there must be a showing of a, quote, previous debtor-creditor relationship between the parties. So I looked at the complaint to see if it did make that allegation, and I found that the following allegations made that showing. The allegations in the complaint were, quote, Cutler retained Blazer for legal services. Blazer performed those legal services, and Cutler failed to pay. Those allegations did not, however, identify any particular contract. For instance, there was no date identifying any particular contract. There were no terms of any particular contract identified or alleged. And there was no date of any breach of contract alleged. So I regarded those general allegations as just necessary supporting background information to support the previous debtor-creditor relationship. We proceeded to a couple of days before trial, and I submitted a trial brief on behalf of my client. And in that trial brief, took the position that since the complaint listed only a single cause of action, account stated, no other causes may be tried. Well, within about an hour of serving that trial brief on opposing counsel, opposing counsel filed a written motion to amend its complaint to add four new causes of action, including a breach of contract cause of action. In other words, I believe Blazer Olson knew there was no breach of contract cause of action in its complaint, and that's why it hurriedly sought to add that cause of action by amendment. Cutler objected to the motion to amend, citing undue delay because it had been like 440 days they'd been sitting on just a single account stated claim, and 2 days before trial they sought to amend. So undue delay and prejudice. We proceeded the next day to trial, and at the very beginning of trial, Blazer's counsel reminded the court it had a pending motion to amend its complaint, and the court asked, and I think this is telling. Oh my goodness. I guess those things happen. I think this is telling. When Blazer's attorney commented that it had a pending motion to amend, the magistrate asked, quote, You began your complaint on the theory of account stated. I think that's important in the scheme of things. And Blazer's counsel answered, I believe that's still a viable legal theory. I just think that adding these other causes of action will make sure we get to the ultimate issue and not, you know, worry about technicalities. These are all in the transcript and cited in the briefing. The magistrate said, all right, well, I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow you to proceed with the complaint you filed and allow you to move to amend to conform to the pleadings, should that be necessary. Then at the conclusion of the trial, Blazer's counsel said, I guess I'll orally make a motion to amend the complaint to conform to the evidence to, quote, add claims for breach of contract and then three other new causes of action as well. And Cutler again objected and referred the magistrate court to her written objection and memorandum that was contained in the record. But over Cutler's objections, the magistrate allowed the amendment to the complaint, saying, quote, I think that the existence of an account stated presumes that there's a contract. I think that's where the magistrate abused his discretion, because that's not the appropriate legal standard. The existence of an account stated does not presume that there's a contract. That's explained in more detail in the briefing, Your Honors. The court invited post-trial briefing. And in her post-trial brief, Cutler argued three points. One, allowing Blazer to add four new causes of action at the conclusion of trial unduly prejudiced Cutler's defense. Two, under Rule 15b1, an amendment to conform pleadings to the evidence introduced at trial should be authorized only when it does not substantially change the cause of action. In this case, there were four new causes of action added. And three, since Blazer's motion to amend set forth new causes of action, those new causes of action added by the amendment did not relate back to the date of the original complaint. And I asked the court to look at Wing versus Martin, 107 Idaho 267. For that point on relation back. That's Wing versus Martin, 107 Idaho 267. And since the new claims did not relate back to the date of the original complaint, the breach of contract action, which was added, was time barred under the statute of limitations, Idaho Code 5-217, because it was the statute of limitations is 4 years on an oral contract. The amendment was added, breach of contract cause of action was added 4 years and 7 months after the alleged breach. Nevertheless, in its findings of fact, conclusions of law, the magistrate granted Blazer's motion to amend its complaint, saying that to complain that she was prejudiced lacks merit. But what completely shocked my client and I was the magistrate court's conclusion of law that, quote, the complaint establishes a cause of action for breach of contract. This was shocking because all the while that Blazer was making motions to add a breach of contract claim to his complaint, the magistrate never once indicated that he found such a cause of action anywhere in the complaint. So that raises the question, when did the magistrate first see a breach of contract cause of action in the complaint? If the magistrate saw a breach of contract cause of action in the complaint during trial, then surely he would have mentioned that, and surely he would have denied the motion to amend to add a breach of contract cause of action, because it wouldn't make any sense to add a cause of action for breach of contract if one already existed. But none of that happened at trial. So given that chronology, where the magistrate only found the breach of contract cause of action 45 days after trial concluded, when he's drafting the findings of fact and conclusions of law, it raises a question about whether the court used hindsight to discover the breach of contract cause of action in Blazer's complaint. But as the court in a Washington case, Trask versus Butler, 123 Washington 2nd, 835, reasoned, quote, in hindsight, it's easy to view facts and agree that they support a claim. It is much more difficult, if not an impossible task, to predict whether a plaintiff will raise such a claim when it's not alleged in the complaint. But, Your Honors, just because the magistrate found a breach of contract cause of action in the complaint does not mean that Cutler had notice of that breach of contract cause of action. Again, the key issue is what, quote, whether the adverse party is put on notice of the claims, whether Cutler was put on notice, not whether the magistrate found it, but whether Cutler had notice of the claim. That's the Sininger case, Sininger Law Office case. So Cutler appealed to the district court. Now the issues on appeal: did the district court err by holding that Blazer's complaint provided notice of a breach of contract cause of action? Just checking the clock, Your Honors. The district court held that Blazer's complaint did provide notice of a breach of contract cause of action and provided three reasons for that. One, he said the complaint contained, quote, the elements of a breach of contract. Two, he said that if Cutler's claim of inadequate notice was to succeed, then Blazer, quote, must not have been able to prove a breach of contract based on its allegations contained in the complaint. That's a 12b6 standard there. And three, that Cutler acknowledged the existence of a contract, and in turn, a possible breach of contract claim because of the affirmative defense in her answer. Well, let's take each one of those in order. First of all, providing notice of a breach of contract claim requires more than merely reciting the elements of breach of contract. The key issue, as just mentioned, is whether the adverse party is put on notice of the claims against it. This appears, Your Honors, to be a subjective test, although I haven't read that it's a subjective or objective test. That's my interpretation. But if the inquiry is whether the adverse party is put on notice, I think that has to go to, was Cutler put on notice? Now, in Brown versus City of Pocatello, that's 148 Idaho 802, the court held that, quote, a complaint must provide some indication of the theory of recovery supporting the relief sought. A naked recitation of the facts alone is insufficient. So in this case, the district court's reasoning that runs directly counter to that found in Brown versus City of Pocatello, merely listing the elements of a cause of action is not sufficient. There must be some indication of the theory of recovery. Point two, this 12B6 thing that Blazer must not have been able to prove a breach of contract. I just give that short shrift. 12B6 shouldn't have been used in determining whether there was notice. Just inappropriate test. And the third point about Cutler acknowledging a breach of contract by virtue of her answer and the affirmative defense in her answer. There's a line of cases that have addressed that, Your Honors. Zatiero versus Homedale School District, Sininger Law Office versus North Pacific Insurance, and Vendelin versus Costco. All of those looked at a defendant's answer and tried to determine or glean from the answer whether the defendant acknowledged a claim. But then there's a more recent case in that line of cases. Villa Highlands LLC versus Western Community Insurance. That's 148 Idaho 598. And in Villa Highlands, the court took a wider view of the proceedings than the other, earlier cases to determine whether a defendant was on notice of a breach of contract claim. The court looked well beyond the defendant's answer. The court looked to the briefings on motions and arguments presented by counsel. So applying that wider view of Villa Highlands to this case, I think the court will find that Cutler did not have notice of a breach of contract claim. She read and understood the complaint as she wrote, only to contain a single cause of action that was account stated. Appellate issue number two, did the district court abuse its discretion in granting the motion to amend the complaint? The district court held on appeal that the trial court was within its discretion to grant the oral motion to amend to conform to the evidence at trial because, quote, the elements of breach of contract were present in the complaint. Well, an amendment to conform to proof is authorized only when that amendment does not substantially change the cause of action. And here, whereas Blazer's motion to amend its complaint introduced four entirely new causes of action at the conclusion of trial and called for substantially different evidence, it was error for the trial court to grant the motion, and it was also error, I think, to affirm that the trial court's decision to grant that motion. Second, assuming the motion was granted, now we've got these four new causes of action, including the breach of contract cause of action. That breach of contract cause of action I knew the UPS man would come. Caesar. He's going to be gone. So relation back. Because the amendment added a breach of contract cause of action at the conclusion of trial, and because it was a new cause of action, it does not relate back to the date of the original complaint, and therefore it's time barred. An account stated, I'll just go ahead. Some of the facts on the different two causes of action, account stated and the breach of contract, those two causes of action. The account stated cause of action arose in the year 2016, when the allegation said there was some agreement by silence. But that's the account stated cause of action. The breach of contract cause of action supposedly arose 3 years earlier in 2013, when apparently Cutler didn't pay on time, although the complaint didn't indicate any dates of formation of a contract or date of breach. We only learned that after the fact during the trial. So those two causes of action are independent causes of action. Breach of contract in 2013, account stated in 2016. They're not related. They rely on entirely different facts. The attorney-client contract, one whole ball game. The account stated is an entirely different ball game. All whole different facts. So that breach of contract claim does not relate back to the original date of complaint. Final few appellate issues. Did the district court err by concluding that Blazer was the prevailing party on both causes of action? I'll just simply say the trial court made no finding of mutual assent to the account stated. Therefore, it could not possibly have determined that Blazer prevailed on the account stated claim, because mutual assent is a key component of account stated. Next, did the trial court, or should the trial court's judgment be remanded for new findings of fact and conclusions of law? And the reason I raise this question, Your Honors, is because the trial court adopted inconsistent positions here on whether Blazer's complaint included a breach of contract cause of action. As I've mentioned, during the trial, nobody, the opposing counsel, nor me, nor the judge, saw breach of contract cause of action in the complaint. None of us did. Blazer was consistently trying to add it by amendment. Cutler was consistently objecting to the amendment. It wasn't until much later after the trial that the judge said, oh, well, there was a cause of action for a breach of contract there all along, yet he granted the motion to amend. So what is it? Is it that the cause of action existed all along, or was the cause of action added by amendment at the end of trial? I need some clarification on that. And finally, award of attorney's fees to Blazer as the prevailing party should be reversed, because the trial court concluded Blazer was the prevailing party only on the breach of contract cause of action. But because there is no breach of contract cause of action properly before the court, Blazer couldn't have prevailed on the breach of contract cause of action, Your Honors. So I appreciate the court's hearing Ms. Cutler's appeal this morning. You have questions, I'm certainly willing to address them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Ferris, you may present the respondent's argument.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Ferris. I represent the plaintiff respondents in this case, Blazer Olson and Lloyd Chartered. And we are here today, Your Honors, and we ask that the court would affirm the district court's decision in this case. similar to Mr. Lewis, I've got an outline that I'll follow. Obviously, would be happy to answer any questions along the way if Your Honor, see fit to ask those. But I think it's important to start here. Mr. Lewis went down the issues, and I'll go down the issues as well. But if we start with the standard here, the standard of review in this case is somewhat limited, in my opinion. This court does not review the decision of the magistrate court. It simply to either reverse or affirm the decision of the district court is the standard of review that should be applied in this case. And as Mr. Lewis indicated, the key rules here that are in play are the Idaho Rules of Civil Procedure number 8 and Idaho Rules of Civil Procedure number 15B1. Mr. Lewis went down the history of the case a little bit, and I think that's appropriate here to understand. It was a long drawn out case before it got to trial. And there were a lot of moving parts within the case. And then Mr. Lewis correctly identified that shortly before trial, he submitted an amended answer to add, and the only thing they added in the answer, I think, is important. The amendment that they made in the answer was specifically related to the contract claim that they should be barred, or they put an amended affirmative defense for contract, for breach of contract. And then shortly before trial, he does a trial brief, and he asks the trial court to make sure that they could not bring any or talk about any other issues in the trial outside of this specific one count of accounts stated. And I think that goes against what Rule 15B would say. And we looked at the Dunlop v. State, which is 141 Idaho 50, which the purpose of that rule is to allow cases to be cited on the merits rather than upon the technical pleadings, the technical pleading requirements. And so they file an answer that talks about the breach of contract. Then they file a trial brief that says, we also don't want them to be able to talk about anything else. It's almost like arguing both sides of the coin. And I think we point that out in our briefing. You can't say that you didn't have notice when you then are arguing that he should not be able to argue about those things. I mean, that clearly indicates that you have notice. And the whole purpose of this notice pleading is to keep things simple and then to make them decided on the merits, not on these technical formalities. Quite simply, in this case, the elements didn't change. They want to state that there was an issue with being able to address these different claims, but the claims all relate back to the same facts, the same elements. They don't change. And it, as the district court found and as the trial court found, the elements of the contract are essentially the same elements that go into an account stated, unjust enrichment, quantum merit. I mean, they all relate back to the same facts. So in their briefing, they likened this to a cat and a dog. And essentially that's not correct. The elements of the contract are all there inside of the pleading. We have a case where the defendant, appellant in this case, paid a retainer for legal services. Legal services performed to their conclusion. Then there was money owed, and that money was never paid for the legal services. That doesn't change in the account stated. It doesn't change in the breach of contract. Wouldn't change in the other causes either. And I think it's important to note that the court in the trial mentioned this as well. Weren't you put on notice just by the pleadings itself that there was a contract? Wouldn't there have to be an underlying contract in order for there to be an account stated? And there was some discussion about that, but ultimately, that's where the court comes out of this, which is there was a contract. There couldn't be an account stated if there wasn't a contract in the beginning. And so in this case, all of the elements of the contract are there, and they were there. They were understood by Cutler and his attorney. In fact, I think that was part of the negotiations prior to that. But in the end, it didn't change any of the evidence. It didn't change any of the facts. It didn't change anything. It's not like the city of Pocatello case, where we were talking about two distinctly different causes of action that required all sorts of different facts, all sorts of different evidence. This is not that. It's still the very simple understanding of we were hired to perform legal services. We performed the legal services. We did not get paid for those legal services. And this is the amount that we were not paid for those. When he goes through the issues here, did the district court err by not holding the trial court, by holding that the trial court did not abuse its discretion and granting Blazer, Olson, and Lloyd's motion to amend the complaint to conform to proof at trial? Again, in that rule 15B1, the rule states if at trial a party objects that evidence is not within the issues raised in the pleadings, the court may permit the pleadings to be amended. The court should freely permit an amendment when doing so will aid in presenting the merits, and the objecting party fails to satisfy the court that the evidence would prejudice that party's action to defense on the merit. So the court is supposed to, by rule, freely permit an amendment, as long as that doesn't prejudice the other party, which again, if you've got notice, so much that you amend your answer to a breach of claim, if notice, that's a rule specifically allows the court to amend those pleadings as long as it does violate the other points there. And again, I think the whole point in the Dunlop case is that they want these to affect
Seems that we've lost Mr. Ferris momentarily.
Judge Gratton, would you like me to stop the recording?
In the past, I understood that there was an issue in a prior oral argument. We were able to get, there he comes back, on the phone.
Yeah. Okay. If he just opts out of audio or video, it might be work better.
Mr. Ferris, are you on with audio? Mr. Ferris, your audio is muted. And we lost you there for a little while.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I went out, but I did drop, I guess. I don't know if that's my fault or what happened.
It appears as though it's perhaps your internet. You are freezing sometimes, and then we lost you entirely for a moment there. Let's try again if we can, but we may have to go to just audio.
Okay, so it's out. Can people hear me?
We can now, yes.
Okay, so you're freezing on my side too. I don't think that's as big of a deal as if I'm freezing. I could go to just audio if that would make more sense.
Yeah, we might try that.
Okay, let me see if I can do that. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so I'll restart here. So again, I think this was understood and recognized by the district court. And they recognized that the trial court had this ability to make this decision. It was certainly within their discretion. And this determination was made by the district court in full review of the case. So they reviewed the case in its entirety. And again, they understood that the trial court, based on the evidence and based on the information in front of it, had this discretion to make this decision to allow for the amended complaint. And as we pointed out in our brief, essentially, I think what the defendant appellant wants in this case is to get free legal services. I mean, that's essentially what they're asking for, and that's what justice would require. Their brief, and they state that the allowing the amendment did not do justice for the case, and that justice would be for the legal services to receive those legal services and not pay for them, and that would be the most just result. And so, again, without changing the circumstances, without changing the facts, without changing anything, all of these causes of action that were added, they all relate back to this same idea. We contracted to do legal services. We did the legal services. She did not pay for the legal services. That's account stated. That's in the breach of contract claim as well. The account stated simply, I think that the elements of the account stated is a document, a writing which exhibits the state of account between the parties, the balance owed to one another, and when assented to, either expressly or impliedly, it becomes a new contract. So again, we're talking about a new contract based on all of the same elements that an underlying contract would have as well. That's exactly what we're talking about here. We haven't changed anything. I don't think it's that complex. The argument by the defendant appellant here is that there was that it substantially changed the cause of action, but this is not a substantial change in any way. The elements are exactly the same. As far as the account stated goes, in that element, the assent piece is maybe the piece that's that is at issue. I believe the court has said that in some circumstances, assent could be inferred from a failure to timely object when a statement is rendered. And in this case, she never objected to the final amount. She simply she offered some negotiations. She wanted to settle it for less than what she owed. Those were all offered in an attempt to settle the account, but she never objected to the amount specifically. And that's when you get to the attorney's fees portion of this and who prevailed. Well, who prevailed and then attorney's fees, but clearly the trial court heard testimony, took evidence, did everything that they needed to do, and in the end ruled that they that Blazer Olson Lloyd prevailed in this specific action. And they could have done that in either way, Your Honors. They could have done it via the breach of contract, since the elements were there, or as the account stated, since the elements were met as well. So they could have prevailed on either side of that, and because they're the prevailing party, then I believe attorney's fees are appropriate in this case. And so as I'm going through the elements, I think it's clear that the district court was within their discretion to allow that. That notice was given. The trial court and the district court both recognized that notice was there in the way of elements. And then in the end, the prevailing party was Blazer Olson Lloyd. I don't think there's any doubt of that. And so attorney's fees were appropriate. So we would just ask that in this case, that you affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Ferris. Mr. Lewis, you may present the appellant's reply. And you'll need to unmute.
There we go. Thank you, Judge Grant.
Sure.
Opposing counsel says the Cutler's affirmative defense recognized a breach of contract. No, it didn't. It merely anticipated that a breach of breach of contract claim could possibly be added, but in the future. So we're just sort of shooting a warning shot across the bow saying, hey, look, anything more than 4 years old is barred, time barred. But Cutler certainly didn't acknowledge that there was an existing breach of contract cause of action. Opposing counsel says the elements of a contract are all in the pleading. We've been over that. No. We don't know. It says Cutler retained Olson, but when, in 1975? We don't know. I mean, what contract are they talking about here? Allegations of time and place, Your Honors, are material. So you know what we're talking about. Under Rule 9, if there's no allegation of a date, the formation of a contract, we have no idea what contract they may be talking about. There were no terms of the contract identified. There is no contract attached as an exhibit to the complaint. So we don't know what contract they're talking about. It was not a well-pled complaint there, Your Honors. And there was no date given on any breach. In fact, the word breach was not used in the complaint. Next, they say that the amendment to conform should have been authorized, but again, it's only authorized when the proposed amendment does not substantially change the cause of action. Here, the proposed amendment to conform to the evidence presented at trial did substantially change the causes of action. The Blazer's own words are, we want to add new causes of action. We want to add four new causes of action. It did substantially change the litigation. Next, you say that Cutler just wants free legal services. Well, I'm not going to even dignify that comment with a response. We just want the law to be applied correctly. Next, opposing counsel argued that there was not a substantial change in the cause of action by the amendments because essentially an account stated and the original attorney contract are essentially the same. No, they're not essentially the same. The original attorney contract, attorney-client contract, apparently was formed in 2012. The account stated was apparently formed in 2016, 3 or 4 years apart, entirely different factual situations. And if you'll look in the Cutler's appellant's brief, it's on page 27 of her brief, that's in the record, at page 196. Appellant's brief, page 20, that's in the record at page 189. It says that the an account stated is an independent cause of action from the underlying contract. Independent cause of action. They're not related or connected. There's no nexus between them. An account stated constitutes a new contract distinct from any original agreement, and the amount or balance agreed upon constitutes a new and independent cause of action. That's 1 Amter Second Accounts in Accounting Section 4. So an account stated and the underlying attorney-client contract, entirely different causes of action. Finally, an observation I came across on the attorney's fees, and Idaho Legal Aid is not requesting in this appeal that it be awarded attorney's fees should we prevail. We just want that attorney's fees not be awarded to Blazer Olson. But here's what I came across. It seems like the trial court awarded attorney's fees under 12-120 subparagraph 1, but the district court on appeal awarded attorney's fees to Blazer under 12-120 subsection 3. I don't know. I always get confused when I get into these issues on attorney's fees, but it seems like and Blazer Olson has always asked for attorney's fees under 12-120. I don't think that's the appropriate statutory basis. I think it's 12-120 sub 3, but it hasn't asked for that.
So, thank you, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate it.
Thank you. The court appreciates the arguments of counsel today in your briefing and everyone's patience with this new technology we're using and those issues that we face. Appreciate that. This matter will be taken under advisement and a written opinion will be issued in due course. The court will be in recess until the 1:30 oral argument. Thanks again.
Thank you.